Welcome to the RSA Events Podcast, the home of world-changing ideas and debate.
It's my great pleasure to welcome our distinguished guest speakers, Richard Bonk and Jens Beckers. Richard Bonk is a visiting fellow in the European Institute at the London School of Economics. His research interests include the role of imagination and language in economics and the epistemology of markets. Jens Beckers is Professor of Sociology and Director of the Max Planck Institute for the Study of Societies in Cologne, and his award-winning research focuses on economic sociology and social theory. They join us today to share the latest thinking from their new book, Uncertain Futures. And really, the book, the title of the book, really illustrates exactly the challenge that exists for our economies and our wider society. How do we navigate radical uncertainty, recognise that radical uncertainty is shaping our future, but at the same time be able to plan for risk and uncertainty in the future? In the book, they examine how economic actors are using narrative and calculation to visualise the future when acting under uncertain conditions. They argue that in capitalist economies that are characterised by relentless innovation and a quest for novelty, think about emerging technology, think about data, AI algorithms, the variables in our decision-making become increasingly unknown. We really have to face and deal with these challenges in increasingly complex systems. And they offer a fascinating account of how we can forecast the future and the extent to which we can forecast the future when variables are so incalculable. And they argue for a new form of economics and thinking that takes seriously the shared calculative devices and social narrative that help us navigate uncertain times. After their opening presentation, I'll be engaging both our speakers in some follow-up conversation, and of course there will be an opportunity to ask some questions open out to the floor. Carry on, that's enough for me from now. Let's get started. Please welcome Jens Beckers and Richard Bonk. Thank you.
Thank you very much for this kind introduction. Thank you very much for the invitation to speak here today. I will talk a little bit about the background of this talk, in the sense that I will present a little bit the book that stands in the background of this book, and will present main ideas. And then the main part of the talk will actually be delivered by Richard Bonk, who will elaborate on some of the things that I will just sketch on. So let me say that this doesn't work. That's a good start. So, or is it just me? No, here I need help. It doesn't work. Ah, here we go. So, this is the book that stands in the background of our talk, a book that was just published a couple of weeks ago under the title of Uncertain Futures. It is an edited volume which comprises 13 chapters which come from a very different perspective. There are chapters on economic forecasting, there are chapters on central bank governance, there is a chapter on innovation policies. There's a chapter on how political claims are made on the Arctic in the future, when climate change has opened up new opportunities for economic activities in the Arctic. So it's a broad spectrum, yeah, of topics. But all these chapters are held together by one central question, namely the question of how do actors, economic actors, political actors, do make decisions and can make decisions under conditions of radical uncertainty. How do they act despite the uncertainty they are facing? Now, this book has two predecessors, and that's also how we actually came together, in two monographs. One in 2009, published in 2009 by Richard Bonk, The Romantic Economist, which is a treatment of economic thought and romanticist thinking in the 19th century and the impact this kind of thinking can have actually on our understanding of the economy. And then this book, To the Right, Imagined Futures, Fictional Expectations and Capitalist Dynamics, which is a book about what role imaginaries of the future do actually play for explaining the incredible wealth development, wealth creation that takes place since the Industrial Revolution. It is from these two monographs that we got to know each other and which brought us to the other book. Now let me talk a little bit about the main points of the argument. The starting point of this book is this notion of uncertainty or radical uncertainty. So in modern economies, decision makers are confronted with, can we call it radical or fundamental uncertainty, which makes it impossible to understand decisions as economic standard models are doing it as simply as an optimization problem or as a rational calculation. Uncertainty means that in many situations there is genuine novelty. Situations are highly complex in their causal structures, and in these situations, outcomes of decisions cannot be known in advance and can also not probabilistically be calculated. And now, exactly in these situations, the question becomes, how do actors actually make, intentionally rational actors, make decisions despite the uncertainty they face? And the answer we give in our introduction, but which is also then pursued in the chapters in the book, is very much straightforward, namely to say in such situations, in conditions of fundamental uncertainties, actors supplement rational calculation with imaginaries and narratives. Now, this has great consequences. First of all, that decisions and outcomes depend on which imaginaries and narratives are seen as credible by actors. And then credibility itself depends also on the rhetorical market or political power of actors to make their stories count. So which narratives actually have an impact is also an expression of power in the economy. Yeah? The struggle for dominant interpretations of a situation or for credible stories is, in today's economy, a main means of competition, actually. Now, if this holds, as we claim in the book, then this also means that we have to think very differently about economics or about an academic approach to the economy. Namely, this can not simply be understood as an exercise in rational calculation, but rather the way our economy functions has a lot to do with the imaginaries of the future that actors develop, or the term that Richard Bronk will also talk about fictional expectations. Now, before turning over to Richard, let me just briefly say a few more words about this notion of uncertainty. And in principle, we can connect very well here to the work of the early 20th century by Joseph Schumpeter, who had an acute sense of understanding the capitalist economy as a dynamic economy, which is characterized by a constant drive towards novelty. Now, if this is the characteristic of our economy, then it follows from this and also from Schumpeter that we cannot understand the economy simply as a exercise in rational calculation, because what is actually invented in the economy, we cannot anticipate before it has actually been invented. So this novelty is one ontological source for uncertainty, but it is not the only one. The second one is that contemporary economies are simply so complex in their causal relations that it is impossible for anybody, even if you would want, or in principle it would be possible to make the calculations, to actually do so. You will leave out many aspects that are relevant for the development of the situation. And then thirdly, there's a political element in it, namely markets and the economy can be surprised. And I mean, here in this country, yeah, but also more generally, we all know what it means, yeah, that economies and economy get surprised by political developments. Now, this has consequences for how we think about economic decision making. We cannot, as economic theory, especially rational expectations theory thinks, see the future as simply a shadow of the past, yeah, where we see the information that we have from the past, the statistical information from the past, and develop and think that the future will be developing in line with these statistics. Yeah, this is not the way we can think about an economy that is characterized by novelty. So we need to be aware that the effects of decisions become unpredictable because of complex social chains involved. Yeah, that means in an economy, it is not only that the situation is complex, the decision situation to understand, but also what needs to be understood is how other actors react actually to the decision of others. That is another source of uncertainty coming in. So this leads to the point that a theory which starts from the presumption that optimal decisions can be calculated and that expectations are determined by the set of information available misses a crucial part of what actually characterizes our contemporary economy. And now I give the floor to Richard Bronk, who will elaborate on this further.
Thank you, Jens, and thank you to Rima, and thanks to the organizers for inviting us. Now, the main motivation for our book and our call for a new narrative economics is that standard economics does not provide the answer to this question of how expectations are formed and decisions made when uncertainty prevails. To be fair, economics does take information problems and cognitive biases seriously as barriers to fully rational expectations. But what we're talking about is not these predictable and potentially correctable framing biases and information asymmetries, however important they are. Instead, as Jens has just explained, our focus is on the underlying radical uncertainty caused when innovation, the imagining of new options, breaks the predictable links between the past and the future. It is this uncertainty that economics largely ignores or conflates with what Frank Knight called measurable risk. In other words, standard economics assumes that the future is always a statistical shadow of the past, and except for random events, can be predicted in probability terms with the help of sufficient data. Indeed, economics generally assumes that once you've allowed for predictable distortions of framing biases and information asymmetries, economic agents will converge on rational expectations. They will internalize the correct model of how the economy works and avoid systematic errors in forecasting because they'd otherwise lose out in competitive markets to those with more rational expectations. Now, these assumptions summarized here might be valid in a world of stable parameters. But our point is that in conditions of radical uncertainty, when expectations cannot be anchored in pre-existing objective probability functions because the future has not yet been created, then you have no choice but to rely on imaginaries and narratives on how we collectively imagine the future will be. So imagination is then both a cause of uncertainty and one of our main tools for coping with it. What is more, as Robert Boyer and David Tuckett show in our book, the greater the level of uncertainty, the more we rely on simple and beguiling narratives to guide our expectations and behavior. And because the visions and narratives we adopt help create the future in their own image, so long as they're internalized by sufficient numbers, outcomes depend on who has the power, the market, political, and rhetorical power to make their visions and stories count. And I'll come back to this in a moment. But first, let me explain how we characterize the nature of expectations in conditions of uncertainty. We argue you should see them as fictional rather than rational. When the future is not already given, when it cannot be assumed to exist as an objective shadow of the past, when there is no fixed anchor in underlying reality for the expectations of even the most rational actor, because the future does not yet exist and cannot now be known, then your expectations must be fictional in the sense of going beyond observable truths. It's not that your expectations are willfully unrealistic or false, but rather that they contain imaginaries as well as known facts. What is more, in conditions of uncertainty, your expectations tend to be fluid and experimental and involve imaginative play with different images of the possible future. And crucially, your expectations do not normally take the form of mathematical probability forecasts. Rather, they adopt a narrative structure and rely on the rhetorical power of language and metaphor for the degree of conviction they excite. Now, fictional expectations differ from literary fictions, of course, in their impact. If they appear desirable and feasible, then you may aspire to act in ways designed to bring about the imagined future. If, on the other hand, they fill you with anxiety or disgust, they may incite action designed to foil the imagined future. But the point remains that your expectations are contingent products of how you happen to imagine and will the future to be. Now, these imaginaries are not, though normally, individually formed. Instead, the fictional expectations that motivate you are the product of shared social narratives and the public images conjured up by key opinion formers. As a result, market prices and behavior reflect the contingent and socially constructed visions and stories that influence decisions. It is this that provides the rationale for what Robert Shiller calls narrative economics, the study of the stories that motivate behavior and the narrative revisions that cause disjunctions in market behavior. It is this, too, that explains why, as Keynes famously observed, market traders are so attentive to the market psychology and narratives. The direction of stock prices is determined by which stories carry most conviction. Now, that is all very well, you may say, but don't we see traders, investors, and policymakers ever more reliant on mathematical models that appear to calculate the very macroeconomic futures that we insist are radically uncertain? How are these models being used if the expectations they give rise to are fictional? Well, it's certainly true that fictional expectations make explicit use of calculative devices and models. Indeed, we argue these devices should be seen as instruments of the imagination. Several chapters in our book analyze how calculation devices organize and subject to rigorous analysis visions of the future that have their origin in imaginaries. The business plan is used to assess the feasibility of capturing an imagined new market in the light of known constraints. The dividend discount model helps agents visualize, explore, and value options that might not otherwise have been articulated. Likewise, a variety of forecasting technologies are used as diagnostic tools for teasing out systematic regularities and spotting emerging patterns. And they act as scientific props for fictional expectations by elucidating key causal mechanisms. This is a perfect example of what William Hazlitt once called reasoning imagination. Models stress test imaginaries for plausibility in the light of such knowledge as we have about emerging patterns and stable constraints, and they help flesh out different possibilities. And this brings me to a really crucial point. Just because the future is uncertain does not mean we have no clue about the future. There is no binary distinction between being able to calculate future probabilities fully, as standard economics assumes, and being dependent on merely uninformed fantasies. Rather, the key to success in uncertain markets is to use analytical techniques to provide you with informed imaginaries. It is these that enable you to make better judgments of how to act when you cannot know for certain what the best course of action will be. You have to plan for the future and calculate as best you can, but you must always remember that the output of calculative devices, using imagined assumptions and scenarios about uncertain futures, is still to a very significant extent fictional, in the sense of going beyond what can be known as established fact. And this brings us to the vexed subject of economic forecasting. Such forecasts are notoriously unreliable at predicting future outcomes with precision. In macroeconomics, outcomes are often well outside the ranges considered likely by almost all prestigious forecasters. And this raises the question, why, if it is so unreliable, do governments and firms spend millions on forecasting? Well, part of the answer lies in the underappreciated role of the economic forecasting process as a diagnostic tool for teasing out emerging patterns. As Werner Reichmann and Douglas Holmes point out in our book, the foretalking and conversation with a variety of economic actors that forecasters undertake while preparing their forecasts help them identify emerging trends and new scenarios that would otherwise not have been considered. At the same time, their forecasts highlight narrative scenarios and causal mechanisms likely to be relevant even if the point forecasts are almost inevitably adrift. So, for example, while the precise forecasts made by the Treasury in 2016 about the immediate impact of the Brexit vote may have been wide of the mark, many of the causal mechanisms and scenarios highlighted in the forecasts, such as the impact of sterling devaluation on UK inflation and real wages, have proved highly pertinent. Forecasts then can make your fictional expectations better informed about key patterns and constraints, even if, given the uncertainties involved, they are necessarily inaccurate. But forecasts also perform several crucial social roles in conditions of uncertainty. In the first place, they help coordinate your beliefs with others sufficiently to allow for joint investment. When you operate in a complex and innovative economic system where the future is indeterminate and there is no fixed anchor for expectations, you are not only uncertain about the situation itself, you are also uncertain about the contingent expectations and beliefs that other actors are forming in the same situation. And it is this self-reinforcing uncertainty problem that makes it potentially difficult to coordinate action in economic settings. And here forecasts can help. They act as a reference point by creating shared expectations that allow you to act as if the future were knowable. Without working assumptions provided by shared forecasts, there would be very little investment. The problem comes when investors suspend their disbelief too completely, when they forget that forecasts are merely informed imaginaries. Perhaps the most important social role played by forecasts and calculation more generally is to justify and legitimize decisions despite the uncertainty faced. Calculative models help justify decisions by providing reasons for action and evidence of due diligence. This crucial legitimizing role of models and forecasts may be benign so long as their status as generators of informed imaginaries is remembered. But if they're used to pretend that it's actually possible to turn uncertainty into measurable risk, then this pretense can pose a serious threat to stability. Modern managers and policymakers like using calculation devices and models as props for decision making because they meet the requirements of what my colleague Michael Power calls the logic of auditability, with its cultural ideals of precision, proof, and calculability. But this institutional incentive for unwarranted precision can lead to the sort of scientism that Hayek warned about, where decision makers engage in a slavish imitation of the method and language of the mechanical sciences and apply them in ways that are simply inappropriate for the indeterminate and complex socioeconomic subject matter of markets. The result can be a dangerous illusion of control over the unknowable future. We may come to believe, for example, as many investment banks did, that if our risk models say that a generalized crash of the sort seen after August 2008 would be a 25 standard deviation event, then the outcome is almost impossibly unlikely. And the problem runs much deeper than that. The assumptions and modeling practices used constitute the very grammar and internal logic for structured finance markets. As Donald McKenzie puts it, a finance model is not so much a camera recording current pointers to the future as an engine structuring the future by creating the possibility of markets. In other words, the models used create market practices in their own image. Suffice it to say that when models providing the internal logic for structured finance markets involve an underlying confusion between the radical uncertainty implied by innovation and measurable risk, then these highly innovative markets frequently end up reproducing the very uncertainty they claim to control. It is not only models that help structure the imaginaries and fictional expectations that govern your beliefs and actions in conditions of uncertainty, it is also narratives and stories. Narratives are one of the main ways in which you make sense of the world, give meaning to your actions, and create the commitment to act. We are all storytelling animals. We use narratives to convey an imagined future to others and make sense of ambiguous situations. Narratives may serve to integrate existing information and known causal mechanisms into otherwise vague imaginaries. They may take the form of new era stories, promised fortunes, dystopias that must be avoided. They may be influential in their own right or become embedded in the assumptions of forecasts and models. Narratives often assign roles to actors and objects and develop a plot, a storyline of how an imagined future may unfold, or a guiding image of anticipated innovation. Stories help motivate you by delineating an emotionally appealing vision of the future and help counter the anxiety that might otherwise afflict you in the face of uncertainty by simulating possible outcomes and making them feel tangible. In short, narratives help orient you by providing a logic of action and populating the future with imaginaries that seem worth investing in. Stories like forecasts also help solve the coordination problem caused by uncertainty by creating shared expectations and a common roadmap. And since narratives, at least until their weakness are exposed, tend to be self-fulfilling prophecies if internalized by sufficient numbers, they inevitably become an instrument of government policy and political or market power. The shape of the future is partly determined by the market and political battle to establish the dominance of one particular narrative. I don't need to spell out the political significance of this. At a time when simple narratives of taking back control or making America great again seemingly trump any amount of careful analysis, or when dystopian visions of chaos caused by immigration are changing the course of political history. Instead, I want to turn now to specifically economic example, the use of narratives by central banks. As uncertainties in the economic system have multiplied, central banks have found it increasingly hard to anchor expectations to policy goals, not least because it's difficult to influence expectations through traditional monetary policy when interest rates are close to zero. As a result, central bankers have increasingly turned to rhetoric and narratives, or forward guidance, in order to cajole expectations in the desired direction. As Douglas Holmes puts it in our book, by communicating a picture of the future evolution of the economy, a central bank can, in effect, enlist the public's help in reaching desired macroeconomic targets with rhetoric alone. In this way, communication becomes the decisive means to achieve the goals of policy. Or as Ben Bernanke, the former governor of the US Federal Reserve, put it, monetary policy is 98% talk and only 2% action. Perhaps the most famous example of the power of central bank talk was the enormous market effectiveness of the simple statement by Mario Draghi in 2012 that the European Central Bank would do whatever it takes to rescue the euro. These three simple words are generally credited with turning the corner of the euro crisis and bringing stability back to market expectations. The direction of capitalist economies then increasingly appears to be the outcome of a struggle between different state and market actors to establish their narrative as the most credible. And credibility is, of course, increasingly fragile when dealing with uncertain futures. Indeed, central banks constantly risk their credibility by publishing forecasts and linking potential interest rate moves to particular targets, with the risk that their forecasts are overturned by events. It is perhaps for this reason that the Bank of England is trying to improve both the dissemination of its message and its market intelligence gathering by orchestrating sustained two-way conversations with other market players through its network of agencies. These conversations enable the bank to access the narratives motivating other actors for use as discursive input to their own models and forecasts. Indeed, this use of conversation to help decipher emerging trends and beliefs may soon go even further with the establishment by the bank of citizens' reference panels, a policy championed by none other than Rima Patel, here chairing today. Let me finish with a word about managing expectations in innovation sectors of the economy. It is, of course, in radically innovative sectors that uncertainty about the future is most extreme. And yet it's precisely in these sectors that actors need some stabilization of expectations for the coordinated investment necessary for developing new products and processes. If innovative ideas are to corner the resources necessary to make them a reality, they must involve promissory stories that provide a shared script for the future and help coordinate investment. Such blueprints, business plans, and shared narratives determine which development goals and paths are followed and which remain unexplored, thereby reducing the indeterminacy of the future. The research and development trajectories of whole industries are often determined by a battle to establish the dominance of one new era story over others. But herein lies a paradox. It's well understood that innovative ideas are the product of cognitive dissonance, the clash of competing visions, and constant trial and error. Any innovator must be careful to avoid becoming locked into one way of looking at a problem and remain willing to engage in constant narrative shifting to make sense of fast-changing trends. So there's a trade-off here between the advantages of shared expectations and the dangers of an analytical monoculture leading to widely shared cognitive blind spots and a consequent failure to spot new trends and opportunities before it's too late. Indeed, and this is my final point, there exists in many areas of policy and business a similar trade-off. A trade-off between the positive coordination effects of stabilizing and homogenizing expectations to reduce uncertainty on the one hand, and the value of a diversity of expectation-guiding models and narrative frameworks needed to cope with uncertainty, on the other hand. This is perhaps the central conundrum of modern life, Do we attempt to reduce uncertainty by choosing one dominant narrative in the hope of building a world in its image? Or do we embrace uncertainty and remain flexible in how we imagine and narrate the unfolding future? Do we seek to be free from anxiety and boost investment by trying to curtail uncertainty and limit the openness of the future? Or do we embrace the freedom to navigate among the panoply of possible worlds implied by uncertain futures? Almost certainly, we will continue to be tempted by both routes to salvation. Thank you.
Thank you. I mean, I think that's a really thoughtful set of reflections, introduction from the key insights in this book. And one of the things I was very reminded of was an example of an event that happened here in the UK, particularly around what you're saying about competing and contesting narrative, which is that during the course of the discussion about the EU referendum, Brexit, a Europe expert went to Nottingham to talk about the impacts of Brexit on the economy, and spoke a little bit about the impact on GDP. At which point somebody, a resident from Nottingham, shouted at him and said, "That's your GDP, not mine." And I mean, that's a very compelling example, some of what you're describing around narrative and competing and contesting narrative that exists there. But if we go even further back, there's a really interesting question about the 2008 financial crisis and another event that I was very much reminded of when I was looking at the claims made in this book was the event of, obviously the 2008 financial crisis happened, but the Queen then met with a room full of economists and entered that room and asked why nobody had seen it coming, which really, really speaks to your points about forecasting. And my question is this, was that the right question for the Queen to ask? If not, why not? How would you have engaged with and how would you have responded to that, drawing from the insights that you've got here in this book?
Let me maybe start briefly and then hand over to Richard. I think it was the right question to ask. Yeah, it was a very smart question. And if I remember correctly, the answer was a little bit apologetic. We didn't figure it all out and next time we will do better. The right answer would have been because we cannot make predictions which accurately forecast what is happening in the economy. Now, in most instances, whether GDP growth is 2.2 or 2.5%, this is maybe not as consequential. But of course, in 2008, where all forecasting institutes were for 2008 predicting that the economy is roughly going as it went in 2007 already, and then it actually went down several percentage points, this is devastating. But we have to live with the fact that especially about such sudden consequences, we will not get informed by forecasts. Yeah, and I think that this is what we need to understand. Then another issue in this, but is that nevertheless we do need such forecasts. Yeah, this is also what Richard was talking about in the presentation. We need such forecasts to coordinate, for instance. Yeah, and even if they are wrong. And we know that they will also be wrong in the future. We cannot simply say we do away with forecasts. It is the basis on which calculations are being made, and at least the impression of rationality can be maintained.
Yes, I mean, as a British person, of course, I have to start by saying, well, Her Majesty's never wrong. So it was obviously the right question. But I think there are three things I would just add very quickly to what Jens has said. The first thing is that almost all the main macroeconomic forecasters were using one set of models, basically DSG models, if you want the technical term, which is an equilibrium-based model. And those models assume that the economy oscillates in diminishing oscillations around an equilibrium point. And so all the forecasts were very tightly bunched around an assumption that we were heading to a fixed point that was pretty well forecast a year earlier, if you like. There were no forecasts that will have the 6% collapse in GDP or whatever, just none. It wasn't that most didn't get it right, no one got it right. So that's the first point, is I think the central modelling techniques that the central banks and Treasury and everyone else were using were just based on this equilibrium idea, which is a very odd idea to deal with a dynamic, innovative economy. That's the first point I've made. The second is the point about innovation that Jens started with. I think the central intellectual error that economists got wrong before the crisis was not to realize that in financial markets of all places, which whatever else is right or wrong about them, are enormously innovative in creating new products all the time, that it was very unlikely that past data would tell you what was going to happen in the future and that probabilistic forecasts would be the right way of measuring risk. And I think this was a huge problem in the city and a major reason they didn't get it wrong. And also not using diverse models to question and spot, which picks up the point that Jens made.
Right. And just picking up on that point, there is an argument, particularly post-financial crisis, that we do, of course, need to look at additional ways of forecasting or understanding or predicting changes in the future of the economy in particular. And the economist Ha-Jun Chang has argued, you know, there are 9 different schools of economic thought, and off the basis of that, many others have argued that there should be alternative ways of forecasting changes in the economy. But part of the challenge there is that there is a risk then of contradiction and inconsistency. How do we reconcile our desire for, a clear judgment about how to move forward with that risk?
Funnily enough, this is very similar to a question I was asked in this very same auditorium 9 years ago during the financial crisis. And I found myself saying in answer to it, which was a very strange answer at the first point, but I'll come to why, that Yes Minister was a constitutional disaster. And what I meant by that was that the traditional way of providing policy briefs was, on the one hand, on the other hand. One model says this, another model says that. It's you, your job, minister or senior civil servant or managing director, to make a judgment about what to do given that the different models are telling you different things. And I think what we have seen in the last 30 years is a growing tendency both to believe that you could turn policy into a science where there's one right answer, but also what my LSE colleague Michael Power calls this logic of auditability. This idea that basically decision makers want to be presented with a set of arguments that say the model tells you basically what the answer is. And my answer would be, well, maybe you shouldn't be paid as much as senior civil servants and managing directors are paid if you're not paid to make a judgment. If all you're paid to do is to read the output of a model, you don't need to be paid as much.
Brilliant. Thank you. I think that's a really good point upon which to invite the audience to ask some questions. So are there any questions from the audience? And I will go for the gentleman just over there in the middle.
Thank you very much. Keith Best, Wyndham Place Charlemagne Trust. Fascinating insight. I mean, this is really a corollary of what Richard was talking about this so-called imaginary point of equilibrium. We are repeatedly told by the pundits that we're on the brink of a bear market, and that seems to be largely an analysis that, well, this bull market has gone on for so long, it has to be cyclical, and therefore it must end in some way. And indeed, we've seen some fairly major correction within the last few days. How far does that sort of talk, which is based upon historic analysis, or at least a historic assumption that things will happen in a particular way based upon what's happened in the past, becomes a self-fulfilling ordinance? In other words, the more people talk about we must have a bear, we're heading for a bear market, it will happen simply because everybody's expecting it to happen, rather than it not happening in isolation.
Yeah,
Would you like to respond?
Yeah, I think the general point here is that that forecasts and expectations don't accurately predict what is happening, but they influence what actors are doing and thereby influence the future, exactly in the sense of what you refer to now as a self-fulfilling prophecy. Yeah, in economics and economic sociology, there's a lot of talk of performativity, yeah, of theories. And this is exactly what it means, that the expectations actors have with regard to the future have an influence over this future. Yeah. Now, with regard to the stock market, I think this. On the one hand, it is right and a truism, yeah, that any bull market will end at one point. But when it comes to the exact determination of when this will actually happen, we are exactly in this situation that we cannot know. Yeah, we know retrospectively, of course. But whether what is currently going on, whether that is a correction that is minimal and a year from now this is a little episode, or whether that's the beginning, yeah, of a major, yeah, downturn, yeah, that's simply, I mean, yeah, if I would know, or if anybody would know in this room, we wouldn't sit here probably. Yeah.
Brilliant. Any other questions? Lady just over at the back.
Hello. So within the context of the limited nature of the economic predictability and the need to add narrative and perhaps social narratives to policy making and to decision making, how do you suggest that those narratives are in the most healthy way added to the economic theory models to actually perhaps reflect sort of citizenship desires and those narratives a little bit more, and also to therefore direct perhaps the economic results of that?
I mean, this is a really, really good question, and it's not something we particularly cover in the book, which is about economics, but there's a very big political aspect to this. And it's something we've thought about quite a lot. I mean, there is clearly a sense in which the more uncertain the environment, the more populist politicians, for example, realize that simple narratives have enormous traction. And I think one of the challenges for those who would like policy to not be entirely dictated by the narratives of populists is to work out how you combine analysis and calculation with appealing narratives. And I'm sorry, we don't have the answer here. I mean, the only thing that I would point out sort of in recent history is maybe Barack Obama was a very rare example of combining a deeply analytical way of looking at things with an enormously appealing, emotionally appealing, simple narratives that appealed to a very different vision of the future. But I think it's an absolutely crucial point, and I would say that policymakers, I mean, central bankers have completely got this point. I mean, central bankers now spend a huge amount of effort working on their communication in a way that is to help members of the public to internalize their policy goals as their expectations, which then helps, in self-fulfilling terms, mean the policy works out if that succeeds, but also to help guide citizens in having some expectation of what may happen. But I think many other areas of policy have not caught up as much as the central banks perhaps have with the role of public rhetoric, if you want to put it that way.
Thank you. Just to add to that point, there is a body of thinking and a body of literature that try to engage with this question. And a book, the title which I will recommend is called The Political Brain, but it acknowledges that actually progressives find it much harder to communicate in this way because of the complexity inherently in some of their narratives, and looks at how the Democrats in the US have had to grapple with that challenge and deal with that challenge. So I would recommend that, looking at that, if you're interested in that. There's a couple of questions here. So I'd like to take the question first from the gentleman in front and the gentleman behind.
Yeah. Thank you. Terence Bendixson. I'm a senior visiting research fellow at the University of Southampton. I'm also an urbanist working on the future of Shanghai. You've been talking about Western economies predominantly, Western central banks and Western capitalism. Are you able to apply your thinking or make any observations about the way your work relates to what's going on in China, given that the stability there since 1980 is really quite remarkable? Thank you.
Yeah, let me say something about this. It's a right observation that we are talking here about the West, about capitalism, about the contemporary world. And that's important to notice because in traditional societies, now I'm not talking for a moment about Asia, but in traditional societies, the situation is a very different one where the imaginary of the future, yeah, is not one of continuous change, but one of repetition of things that have been known from the past already. So that this uncertainty, yeah, that we are talking about is a specific modern phenomenon. Yeah, in traditional societies you have dangers, but you don't have risks in the sense that activities are done where the consequences need to be attributed to the decisions. Now, with regard to China, I'm not an expert on China or Asia, yeah, but from my just sense of what I know about the situation in Asia, but also in the Middle East, is actually a very similar one to the one we describe here, namely one in which, I mean, a future of a radical transformation of a society is imagined and enacted also. Yeah, and I think that the urban development that is happening is a fascinating example, yeah, for this, in a way, reimagining, yeah, of a whole social and economic and political fabric. Yeah. The comparison I'm inclined to make here is, yeah, Europe in the late 19th and early 20th century, yeah, where I believe, I mean, similar images, yeah, of a radical transformation must have been present. While the imaginaries we have, yeah, in Europe especially, are today much more, I mean, pessimistic. Can we keep what we have? How do we organize a no-growth society, et cetera, et cetera. Yeah, so I would see parallels. And Asia is, I think, especially interesting case to investigate under the perspective that we develop here.
And the only very small thing I'd add to that is I think there is something distinctly Western about the deep contestation of the imaginaries and narratives. So in other words, I think in China, my impression, as a non-China expert, is that the dominance of one imaginary or narrative is much more established, for good and ill.
Thank you very much.
Paul Hudson. I'm not affiliated. I've been retired from academic life for 15 years. I thank both speakers, in fact, for a very eloquent overview of their book. I wish my German were even 10% as good as your English. In fact, after I came back from Germany in 2003, I attended a number of seminars at SOAS. Now, that's a centre of pluralistic thinking. And I was struck by the number of seminars given by young PhD students from Austria, Germany and elsewhere, as well as young lecturers, which in fact were predicting the crisis. So when the people like Lord Hennessy and others from the LSE, Richard Bronk and one or two others are an exception, by the way, but the LSE, for people who don't know, this is a high temple for neoclassical economics whose advice has got over half the world in the mess it's in. I hope I don't sound as if I'm provocative. But they were predicting, in fact, because they took this pluralistic approach. But one of the things that strikes me, and I found this in Germany, was these neoclassical books going into third editions, is the same old stuff that I've been taught in classical economics going back 50, 60 years ago. There wasn't anything beyond that, unfortunately. I mean, there are various centres in Germany as well as in this country which take a non-neoclassical approach. But the point I want to make is Richard Bronx seemed almost, but I think he went back on that, to be a bit sceptical of models. But I think the snag with the models is not model building or the mathematics. It's the wrong sort of mathematics. It's only the models that you look at. I used to teach econometrics and mathematical methods. Is in fact, it's mostly linear and not the mathematics of nonlinear and chaotic systems. This is what should be, I think, appropriate. But I'd like your comments on that. And I think this is one of the reasons why economics education in this country, this is why we have this movement, Rethinking Economics, started up by the students, spread all over the place.
Just to jump on that, so what's your thought on this idea of a wrong sort of mathematics? Do you think is a wrong sort of mathematics?
I mean, to pick up on your last point first, I think it's absolutely right that the much more emphasis needs to be put on complexity economic models and the importance of nonlinear reaction functions, the crossing of thresholds and tipping points and so on. And that's something we do cover in the book. Andrew Haldane looks at the use of agent-based models, for example, which is a very interesting example of that in policymaking terms. I think to the more general point, all models are incomplete. And our argument is not with models. Our argument is with the use of models, some of the use of models. So all models are incomplete, and if they weren't incomplete, they wouldn't be a model, put it bluntly. And where we think economics goes wrong is if there's an assumption that one set of models will tell you all you need to know about the economy. Now, to be fair to most economists, they don't actually hold that view, but they do tend to work in one tradition of modelling, all of them, and partly because of a specialisation issue. And I think a lot of the problems come at the policymaking end, where they want... So the Treasury has generally only one model at a time. It doesn't run several models concurrently. Now, I've never understood why it wouldn't. Instead of replacing the old model, run a new one alongside it and keep the two giving you different answers and then make a judgment about which one is telling you something more interesting in the current predicament. So I think the use of a number of different models as diagnostic tools is what we're arguing for and not for getting rid of models. I mean, that's very much not our view. In terms of where the economics profession is, I think two things I'd say. First of all, there's a big difference between applied economics in places like central banks now. I mean, the Bank of England is almost a temple to pluralistic economics now, for example. And I think in the LSE, to defend it, there are a lot of economists at the LSE who don't agree with standard neoclassical economics. They're not necessarily in the economics department. And that doesn't necessarily matter, because our argument isn't that standard economics is wrong. It's that it's incomplete. It's very, very good at telling you some things about situations where the parameters are stable. Auctions in markets where all the parameters are stable. I mean, it's brilliant at these kind of things. It tells you an awful lot about an aspect of the economy. What it doesn't tell you is how to understand the dynamics of innovative parts of the economy. Now, unfortunately for standard economics, that includes finance and it includes macroeconomics, which is quite a big part of economic reality.
Brilliant, thank you. Well, I mean, some really incisive and rich questions. Unfortunately, I think that's all we've got time for now. I just wanted to say thank you to all of you, and thank you in particular to Richard and Jen for their contribution and their presentation. And would you please be able to join me in giving them a round of applause?
Thanks for listening. If you like this podcast, head to our YouTube channel for inspiring talks, interviews, and animations.